Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Holly Hunter. When Holly Hunter showed up at a casting session for Broadcast News, there was some confusion about exactly what she was there for. Well, she didn't get that PA job, but it got straightened out pretty quickly because she started work the next day, and over the next three decades, went on to turn in some of the most natural and empathetic work I've ever seen in films like Raising Arizona, Roe v. Wade, 13, and The Piano, for what she won an Academy Award. Holly has always held film sets to be sacred, and given her early history working with some of the most talented directors of our time, you can't blame her. It led to some false illusions about the industry, but she's always been crystal clear on why she does what she does. And, as I found out in our conversation, quite honest too. I asked her about finding the confidence to play at such a high level so early in her career, and was surprised to find out that acting was not actually her first choice. But watching her two latest films, The Big Sick and Strange Weather, I was reminded she couldn't have made a better one. In both, she makes me completely believe and understand relationships that we never even see on screen. You'll hear just how she does that, and what was really behind that famous hotel room crying jag. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Holly. You want to take that again? You have
no,
a question?
No.
Well, you were about to say.
Well, I was just going to, you know, I have a fantasy about, that in a way that there is no action, that there's no slate, there's no action, that it's like a tail slate, and that, and I think about this with acting in a movie too, where it's, you just move into it, that there's no prep, that you're just suddenly in the movie.
A cold open.
Cold open.
Let's do it.
Well, you have a format.
No, that's all right.
You know, you have a ritual, and the ritual I respect. But it did make, you know, some directors that I've worked with, very rare, roll when people don't know that they're rolling. And actually, Jim Brooks did it on Broadcast News, where Michael Ballhouse rolled when we were not aware, when we were waiting in between takes.
Right.
He shot some stuff, and it was so remarkably alive. I mean, it's, you know, it's a different kind of aliveness.
Yeah.
And after I realized that Michael did that, I began to observe myself in between takes, and I would go, oh, this is what I should be doing during the scene. How I am right now is how I want the scene to be.
That's so interesting, because it's true. It's almost like when a slate comes in, it makes everybody tense up a little
bit.
It's
totally true. And then, they go quiet on the set, and then suddenly people go, ooh, oh yeah, we're doing this thing. And it loses its unselfconsciousness, its kind of impetuous thing.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Broadcast News, because that was the film I first saw you in, and I just fell in love with that film. And it's kind of amazing. This is a film that came out, what, 87?
87.
James Brooks directed it. And it's one of these films that a marketing department would have a hard time with, because it doesn't follow the tropes of a genre necessarily. I mean, it's romantic and it's comedic and it's dramatic, and there's an ethical dilemma in the middle of it. And it says a lot about us as adults. It says a lot about workplace politics. And it was this film that had such a massive, important role for a woman right in the center of it.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
At that time, did you realize how rare that was at that time?
Well, you know, when I got Broadcast News, I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And I remember that I got, it was tremendously high pressure. I'd been hearing about this, the movie, and that he was looking for this leading female role for about 7 months before I went in.
Oh, wow.
So, and Jim is an not surprisingly, an unbelievably thorough guy. And so he was like auditioning like crazy. And finally, he didn't find what it was he was looking for, whatever mysterious alchemy he was looking for between the actress and the part. And finally they just went, okay, open up the dregs. Let's just see every freaking body. And so then I came in, and they thought that I was coming in for a PA. They thought that I was coming in for to get a production assistant job for
really?
The movie. Said, no, I'm here to audition for the Jane Craig. And they went, oh, okay, well, sure. So so then I got the part. It was an immediate kind of thing, and then I was rehearsing like the next day.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
so on your initial audition, James Brooks was in the room.
Well, on my initial audition, it was Jim and Bill Hurt. They were both
there.
I mean, there was just some misidentification about what I was there for.
Right.
But they didn't really know what I looked like, but it was like, okay, she's here for Jane Craig. So, and listen, we started rehearsals like, you know, the next day after I got the part. So he was really cutting it to the wire. I think, I don't know what his back pocket, you know, alternative would be
right.
with the movie, but I started rehearsals and at the end of the week, I like broke down. I was crying. And Jim said, honey, you know, why are you crying? And I just said, oh, I'm crying because I have an ear infection and I'm kind of sick. And Bill Hurt said, you're crying because you're scared. And it was just like, busted. And Bill is, you know, one of the most amazing actors I've ever worked with. And he has incredible insight, incredible honesty. He's got a straight line to the heart. Is evident in his work with himself and with a fellow actor. You know, Bill can really, he's got clear sight. And it was amazing that he said that. He just named me. And I was embarrassed, but I loved him for it because there was an intimacy between Bill and me. Like from that moment, I just felt that Bill could see me whether I liked it or not.
You know, it's so funny because in the film, I think there's a role reversal in that sort of situation because you play this person who can see right through him in the film.
Oh, totally. And that was also freaked me out because I was like, oh, wow, I don't know if I can do that because Bill's doing it. I mean, Bill's the one. He should be playing Jane Craig. He's the smartest person in the room. How am I going to play somebody smarter than Bill?
Well, okay, so talk about that a little bit because with both Raising Arizona and Broadcast News, you must have walked away from both those experiences going, oh, this film business, it's easy. There's great roles written for women. There's original auteurs with original voices. And
well, yeah.
You just walk right in at the beginning of your career and get these parts.
Yeah, well, there was a certain presumptuousness that maybe you're the only person who's ever said that, but there was a certain presumption on my part of like, wow, so this is life.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that the thing that kind of kills me about that is that my career was so front loaded with people who were born to direct that was difficult. That was the most difficult, in fact.
How so?
Because I was working with people who, man, that's what they should be doing. There was a calling. Many are called, few are chosen. They were the chosen.
I mean, certainly the Coens fit in that category.
And Jim Brooks.
Yeah.
And I worked with Spielberg not long after that.
Right.
And Lasse Hallström is no, you know, chopped liver either.
And Jane Campion.
And then Jane Campion. I worked with Michael Ritchie, who is one of the great American directors ever. I mean, Volker Schlondorf, who did Tin Drum, was at the very, very beginning of my career as well. That's never to be repeated. I mean, I haven't hit that level of one after another of truly inspired.
Yeah.
Directors.
Well, I would think it would give you a false sense of what the business is and of what a lot of actors go through as well. Because I would assume your first couple experiences define the business for you.
Yes, and in that way, it was fabulous because I had like great role models for how things could be and how things should be. They set the bar unbelievably high, and yeah, that can lead to disappointment. But then again, there's a level of how you comport yourself, how you what your expectations should be, can be for the etiquette of a set, for the aesthetic of a set, for what people are, the ambition.
Yeah.
You know, what can you be ambitious for? What could we lean into? What's the unknown? And those guys were, you know, Jim Brooks was courting the unknown, wooing it. And then I had Jenna Rollins, who I had this little streak of working with Jenna. And Jenna was a mentor and continues to be a mentor that, of course, she doesn't know about. But Jenna told me things that very few actors, you know, she knew that she was a mentor to young actors. But the things that Jenna had to tell me are they have legs, you know, like Jenna.
what is an example?
But I mean,
of
one of the things that I was just speaking about it earlier today, oddly enough. But one of the things that Jenna said to me that I have never that has always been gold, and never ceases to be gold, and I have tried to consistently live up to it, is Jenna said, if anything annoys you on a movie set, if you want to like. If you're enraged, if you feel humiliated, if you are unbelievably annoyed, if you are impatient, you know, whatever the emotion is that's a bit outsized, you know, in between takes, something is going on, whatever it is, you know, somebody has just insulted you, or people aren't whatever the we're waiting for a cloud that's never moving up, you know, out of the line of the sun, and we can't shoot until the cloud, and it's like, can we please go? I, you know, the scene is more important than the cloud. Whatever those issues are, keep it to yourself. And she said, because then you can put it into the next take and it will be your fuel. It'll be the fuel for your engine that you need to, and that's invaluable. And
wow.
and any time that I've ever said, can we go? It's like, it's over. You know, that can we go, I should have like just plugged it into action, and it would have been something that I wouldn't have anticipated. It's transportation. And she, you know, it was, you know, incredibly wise.
There's an aspect of falsity to making a movie that cannot get into your performance, and you probably have to be vigilant towards that.
Totally, you know, it's like a real protective kind of thing. You have to really consider it sacred, and that thing, you know, Jenna said that it was very kind of no nonsense, very pragmatic, but in fact, it's just protecting something that's sacred. And movie sets can be like extremely not sacred. Like, let's face it, there's a lot of like looking at now. There's a lot of cell phone stuff. There's time, there's meal penalties, there's, you know, boredom, there's, you know, all these things. And the actor is there to protect the unknown. You know, you want to, what I was saying about Brooks, you want to court the unknown, you know. And sometimes you're the only one doing it, you know. And so there's no one there to protect that but you. And so you got to be the guardian at the gate. And you got to be guardian of your own self. You know, sometimes you have to protect yourself from yourself.
You know, there's not that many people that get thrust into that level of art that quickly and have to deal with those pressures of someone like Bill Hurt saying, oh, she's scared, right? And I think of most people, they get to take one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume Broadcast News felt like you jumped a whole bunch of steps. And I wonder how you got over the fear.
Well, you know, I don't think that I would have been able to have the sense of entitlement had I not. I mean, I went to drama school for 4 years. I went to Carnegie Mellon University and trained for 4 years. And that that training allowed me to go, I'm an actor. I just to be able to say, yes, that's what I am. I'm an actress. I get to be here. I know that I don't know. And that's where I want to, you know, just the sense of entitlement, whereas if I'd just, like, gone from my hometown to Hollywood, I think that that would have been too disorienting and too the overwhelming nature of the level that at which I've kind of found myself at would have been
way. You had your training to go back to.
Yeah, I kind of felt like there were hours and hours and weeks and months and then years of people telling me, you know, how to do stuff.
Right.
Dance and movement and all this training, acting, you know, just the hours alone made me feel that I was entitled to be scared,
right,
but to be there.
I mean, I would just assume that you'd have to draw on something real to be able to muster up that kind of, it's not even confidence. It's like you said, entitlement or ferocity to be able to make that believable in a room. And I just think of the dichotomy of someone breaking down and crying because they're so scared and then having to get in front of camera and command the ship.
But, you know, it's also just like what actors do. And actors are, that's what you're doing. You're pretending to be something that you're kind of not. I mean, you're always pretending to be something. You're pretending to be an orphan or an arsonist or, you know, a country music singer or a divorcee. And none of those things you are, or a mother. And in this case, it was a network news producer, and I had the great inspired guidance of Susan Zirinsky at CBS and Joe Perrin and her husband, who was the Washington bureau chief at CBS. So I got to hang out, you know, with carte blanche. Those guys gave me access to every aspect of their professional lives.
Right.
I just followed Susan around like a little dog. And, you know, was on the other end of all of her phone conversations. And the Iran-Contra scandal was breaking at that time. So I was at the bureau in D.C.
Right.
And I was there training for broadcast news. So I saw Susan under the gun and also enlivened by her job, by her responsibility. It was something that made her much more alive.
Right.
And I saw everybody, the sparkle in the newsroom from what was going down, you know.
That's the great conundrum of being an actor because, yes, you're pretending to be someone you're not. But I think the best actors find something in themselves that they completely relate with so that they can transfer that emotion to us and we believe it too. Like, I think that, yes, you could have been scared and young and inexperienced at that point, but There's some Jane Craig probably somewhere in you too. Do you know what I mean? Is that not valid?
Well, to every role that I've ever done, that person resides in me, you know, to a greater or lesser degree, and sometimes greater, sometimes lesser. And, there are parts that I've done where it's like, wow, I don't even know what I'm doing. And then there are some that there were aspects of Jane, even though I was very, very afraid of doing the part, I feel entitled to my own self. And Jane Craig is definitely an entitled woman, but is driven not by power, but by an ethical responsibility,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That I felt the character was not. She had a very healthy ego, but she was driven by something that was greater, you know, than the sum.
You know what I loved that I had forgotten completely about till I watched it last night was the spontaneous breaking out into tears she almost scheduled into her day, where she would unplug the phone and sit in the bed and all of a sudden these tears would come. And I would think that would be very difficult. Was that in the script from the beginning, or was that sort of developed?
Yeah. No, that was in the script from the beginning. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's also like the impetuousness of acting. It's like the using what is at hand is something that actors do so beautifully. You know, you use what is there. And I remember one of the days that I had to do, it was the day where I was in the hotel room talking to Albert Brooks, his character, and then I unplugged the phone in the hotel room and put, you know, I'm sitting on the hotel bed, and the craft service guy had just been in the on the set offering people like some kind of shrimp or stuffed crab. It was like stuffed crab, hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah.
Stuffed crab. And I, that hurt my feelings so bad that it was like, wow, I'm trying to do something holy here. I'm doing something like sacred. And that he'd been, and I could still smell the stuffed crab in the, and I, that made me weep. And I, you know, and I went, I'm using that. I'm using that because I get to. Because I'm an actor, and this is a direct translation. You know, I hadn't even met Jenna Rollins yet, and it was like that was just an instinct too. It's transportation for me.
And that's so amazing. You're crying about the smell of stuffed crab and the indecency of the interruption.
Totally. And, it was like, you know, it was a sacrilege. And of course, you know, maybe that's a little sensitive of me. I mean, you know, I still feel defiled in some way by things that other people don't feel defiled about at all in a, on a movie set. But I do feel that a movie set is sacred. I do. I can't, you know, it's, I go to that. I want that. And it's an environment that will challenge that because there are so many different agendas.
Right, sure.
On a film set.
Sure.
And when I first started, I was just on the cusp of this no longer happening, but the director would be next to the camera. You know, the director was always in the room.
Right.
And crouching, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And action. And you felt the vibe of that particular person. There's this play, and I remember Judy Dench. It's a David Hare play. It's called Skylight. And at the end of the play, the last line of the play, she says to somebody, she's playing an actress, and she says to somebody, is the director in the house tonight? And it's before performance. And he says, no, he's not coming. And she says, so we're alone. And it's like, wow, you know, what does that mean? We're alone, you know, and it's such a moving line to think like, is she bereft because the director's not there? You know, and she feels lonely that the director, or is she, we're alone, you know.
The cat's away, the mice will play.
Yeah, that special thing, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that directors watch the monitor now and they don't watch performance. And
But that can be a good thing.
Right, and
because
it
you
used
feel
to be.
as an actress, sometimes I feel alone, and it's special, you know, it's special.
Really?
And sometimes I feel lonely. If I really love the director, I want the director to be with me. You know, I mean, it's. But if you don't have that incredible intimacy or kinship with the director, it's good for the director not to be there. I mean, it's totally cool. Because it is work that you do essentially alone. You are alone essentially when you're acting.
There's and all the work you do with leading up, the director doesn't know or doesn't ever have to know all the work you've done for yourself, right?
And that's a beautiful privilege that you can have with your own self as an actor. Or it can, you know, really freak your ass out. so whatever.
Well, you've been working recently on films that I think share a connection, you know, with some of the kind of films we're talking about. Both The Big Sick and Strange Weather are films that would probably be hard to market and go where an audience doesn't expect and almost has a more noble approach to storytelling than a reductive approach to get a bigger audience. I think The Big Sick starts out with a complete misdirect that you're in there watching a comedy about a stand-up comedian's life, and then you end up in this deep story about self-identity and loss and marriage and cultural differences. And you play the mother of Kumail's wife, Emily. And what I found was so interesting was the way I immediately understood more about her as she's laying there and not really in any scenes. I understand more about her through your relationship with her that really isn't in any lines. It's just inferred through the way you take control of the situation, the way you sort of turn a cold shoulder to Kumail. And it made me realize that there was probably a ton of work done on developing your own memory base of time with your daughter.
Well, you know, it's like I remember I was talking to Fran McDormand once, and she was working with Altman and on a movie, and Altman said, hey, Fran, turn around and cross the room out of the scene. But if you scratch your ass when you're crossing out, I'll use it. You know, it's something he can cut to because it's interesting. I mean, it's like there's character stuff there. She's scratching her ass. And I think that, like, in a movie like The Big Sick, where you're establishing a relationship with, in this case, with a character who's in a coma.
Yeah.
So you only see one of us at a time. And she never mentions her mother.
Right.
And she's in a coma, and then I come in. And so, I mean, there were things that I wanted to, I thought, okay, what can we see? You know, there were little things that, you know, I put on one of her sweaters when I go into her apartment. I take one of her sweaters and put it on. I mean, just little things that even if an audience member doesn't pick them up, I sense the immediacy of the action, that I'm relieved to be in her apartment. You know, it's a stressful time in the story, and so when I come into her apartment, I feel a sense of closeness with her. It gives me comfort to be in her place. But, you know, more than anything, what I really wanted to express with Big Sick was it was an opportunity for me to be part of there two women. Well, that's cool. First off, two women with major roles in a movie, hot, and our relationship. And I'm a mom. So mothers are often kind of stereotyped into being, and with Big Sick, it's like, okay, so she's a control freak. Well, I didn't want to be a control freak. I wanted to be a woman who was involved in a deeply, deeply, deeply committed, loving relationship with a child, and a child who they share intimacy. So it's not just, I'm mama bear.
Right.
I didn't want to just be, oh, the mama bear who's like a bitch or a pain in the ass. I wanted to be a woman who is there. I'm her advocate. I'm advocating for her.
Yeah.
And so that when I don't like Kumail, when I want to fend Kumail away, even though it is comedic and that you want, it's a comedy, you want it to be funny. But the bottom line is you haven't treated her well. How do I know that? Because she tells me everything.
Right.
You know, if a daughter is telling a mother everything, that's probably, she's an adult, that's pretty good. That means they've got a great relationship. That's they're she made it to adulthood successfully with her relationship with her mother intact. That's cool. I wanted to describe that. And when we were kind of doing rewrites of the script, I really wanted at the end to be the one to say, it's time for us to go. It's time for us to go home. You are ready for us to go home. Instead of it going, I can't wait to get my parents out of my hair.
Right.
Which I thought was just less interesting. I wanted it to be coming from an intimacy that I know her.
And it makes the role feel much more three-dimensional.
Oh, good. Well, I mean, you know, it was also, you used the word nobility or, you know, a noble kind of endeavor. In terms of making movies, and I thought, wow, that's a great word for The Big Sick, because there was a nobility to doing the movie. There was a nobility to being on the set that is certainly not always there, and sometimes you have to kind of insist on, can we work towards nobility? You know, can we, like, move? But with The Big Sick, and perhaps the reason why that felt like it was natively part is because it was a true story, and Kumail was playing Kumail. and yeah. Emily was at the monitor. The true story was literally with us. And Kumail was serious. You know, he wanted to approach being an actor in the movie with great nobility.
Is that something when you choose roles, you try to sniff out by the script or by conversations if there's something pure in the DNA of the script that will filter down through the whole production?
No. I don't have that luxury. I wish I did. Yeah, I do movies for too many different reasons. Sometimes I need the money, you know. So I'll do a movie for the dough. They're offering me what? Yeah, okay.
That's a very honest statement.
You know, and because that's the real world. That's life.
But it's funny in light of what we were talking about of you know, what the film business looked like after your first handful of films to that reality now.
Yes, but you know what? There's an honor in that because that's real life. And I, you know, I do live a privileged existence, but not too privileged. You know, and I've been, you know, it's like Elaine Stritch with that Stephen Sondheim song. What is it? Some of the, you know, sometimes it's champagne, sometimes it's pretzels and beer, whatever those lyrics are, and I'm kind of butchering them, but that's definitely my life. I mean, I've definitely been, you know, on the party and then not. And sometimes I miss the party, but I also like being part of really, really the real world gives me much more food for my work. New York City gives me more gravitas, more just like here's the real life, the seeing being in the real world, being a passerby. I like that in my life, and it gives me much more of a feel for being an actress, I think. But I mean, yeah, there's no way I could have the luxury of going, would it be in this DNA? I mean, because sometimes I go, I really want to work, I want to do this character. This is a character I want to do. And other things can be compromised about the project, but the character is enough.
Right.
And sometimes I go, well, the script is okay, but this director, I want to be on a set with this director. I didn't feel this way about Crash, because I loved Crash and I loved the script. I love J.G. Ballard, but Cronenberg, he's one of the great directors ever. So I went to work with Cronenberg. It was like, whatever he's doing, if he will put me in it, I want that job. So there's those, you know.
And plus, it must be hard to second guess or to try to predict based upon any one element whether the film's going to turn out well or not, right? Like,
totally.
Have you turned down roles because you tried to do that, where you looked at something and said...
Oh, yeah, totally.
And you've turned and then seen that it's come out
beautiful.
Better than expectations.
Yeah.
Is there regret associated with that?
You know, but that's also, you know, I've had some regrets, or I turned something down that ended up being kind of inspired and lovely. You know, what else is new? I mean, if you're around for like a few decades, first off, you're lucky as shit.
Yeah.
And secondly, you're going to have some regrets. And then you move on, you know, and you just keep going because something else is driving you other than that, you know, like another appetite. There's another hunger. And if you don't, if I'm not hungry to act, if the reward of actually acting doesn't overcome the painfulness of the career, then, you know, I think it's time to stop.
Right. You did this film, Strange Weather, which you're in, I think, every frame of the film. And you play a woman who's lost a son to suicide. And again, like we were talking about earlier, this is a film where the entire source of your grief happens before the film starts. And the audience learns about this relationship with your son through your journey to try to find out more about the last days of his death and what his plans were. And it takes place in a South that I think is much more true to what the South really is. It doesn't look like Sweet Home Alabama. I mean, it looks like the South that has had economic troubles. But what I wanted to ask you about was the work that people don't see that you had to do to be able to transfer to the audience these feelings of did I fail as a parent? Did I miss signs? Did I not know my own son? Could I have done something different? You know, right. And none of that stuff took place in the film. It was all the aftermath.
Well, in the case of Strange Weather, it's really fun to stretch out and get to play a lead role. But Strange Weather it's for me personally, even though the movie is not really an experimental movie, it felt like it was an experimental thing. You know, at first I loved the fact that the movie did not truck in flashbacks.
Dream, that's right.
There were no dream sequence. There was no the past. We never saw the past. We never saw what my son looked like, except for one quick, photograph. And I really treasured that about the story.
It really is a different experience, this film, because there's performances there where I don't know how you do it, how you find a way to relate to something that admittedly is every parent's worst nightmare, is that somehow your child will be so unhappy and you don't catch it and something irreversible happens. It's the worst fear of any parent. And I mean, I don't know how you found the ability to make that so real.
Well, we're all human and we all have intense imaginations. Everyone has intense imaginations, even if they don't really, if they're not cognizant of it. But, you can imagine things within the human experience. And certainly suicide is within many, many people's, it's many people have experienced.
Yeah.
The loss, in that way, and it's just an imagining,
yeah.
As an actor. But that's one of the great privileges, is to try to make people feel more human, make people feel less alone in the world through fiction. You feel more empathy for people.
Do you think that's your job?
Yes. As a storyteller, what you want to do is explain, but just like we have questions about who we are, and you want to, this is the cool thing about The Big Sick, whether that was The Big Sick's MO or not. That's what Kumail and Emily, started, is a story about empathy, just the cliche of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and walking. And that's what fiction does. When you spend time reading a novel, a great novel, you understand.
You get to live another life.
Yeah, you're on another continent, in another country, and you're going, oh, wow, the enlightenment of that is cool. So for me to play somebody who had lost a child in that like brutal way helped me to understand what that kind of loss might be like. And I can't really understand fully, but I can imagine it.
Well, I think imagination is an active pursuit. And so by being forced to develop your character and figure out an approach and everything, you're going to have to more vividly attempt to imagine that. And I guess the byproduct of that would be you would learn more about it than someone else.
But, so many jobs require empathy. If you think about you know, the great doctors in the world are not just like skillful with the knife or whatever, but they have an empathic response to the people that who they're treating who are ill, and nurses are that way. The great police officers in the world, you know, have tremendous empathy. I mean, there are so many positions of power in the world that an empathic approach makes the position brilliant, you know, including, you know, photojournalism, you know, documentarians. Empathy must be a great ingredient in brilliance.
I could never put it that way, but that makes perfect sense to me. Was it interesting to go back and work in the South, being from there? I mean, did you recognize any of the South that you grew up in?
Oh, of course. You know,
it hasn't changed.
It's visceral. You know, the South is a real. It's a visceral place, and. You know, because the air is heavy there, so the air carries the past, and you know, it's a heavy place.
You grew up in Georgia, right?
Yeah.
And did you have a lot of brothers and sisters? Were you a big family?
Five brothers and oh, wow. One sister. Yeah.
Wow. You were a musician first, like you learned to play piano and from a young age, correct?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're in a family that understood the arts and supported that kind of thing. I mean, do you feel like that gave you a different perspective than?
Yeah, that's my outlet because it's fiction.
Were you different as a kid than the kids around you? Like, did you feel different and have different pursuits and interests?
I always felt that way, yes.
You did?
yes, I did. Yeah, I did.
Because I think of my upbringing, and I was different enough to move out of my hometown I was born close to here. I was born in Fullerton, but I was different enough to go, you know, try to do something that was a risk and that was artistic and things like that. And by taking that path, I'm certainly different than most of the people I grew up with.
Well, I think, you know, I was, you know, music was what I found. Music was the thing that, and I love the trip that you go on with music is totally different from any other trip ever.
Right.
You know, I love the lack. It's not verbal. It's nonverbal. It's nonlinear. And there's something about it that the mystery of listening to music or playing music that's not like anything else. You know, not like acting. There's something, you know, I don't know. There's a privacy in music that there's nothing else can touch. And so, yeah, that was my first thing, was with the piano. I just wasn't good enough to play the piano professionally, but if I had been, I would have.
Was that initially what you thought you would do?
Like, total passion. That was big step. I just didn't have the chops. I just didn't have the technical brilliance that I longed to have. But if I had, I would be a professional musician, without question.
Wow.
That would have been my thing. But, you know, I wasn't born with that equipment.
How did that awareness come about?
I just had stage fright. Maybe technically I wasn't, but I didn't have the emotional fortitude. I wasn't built to do it.
Really?
So I played the trumpet and the baritone and French horn and piano. I played music throughout, you know, I completely immersed myself in musical instruments. But acting, I didn't love it more, but I could express myself better. I could express myself in a way that I couldn't with music.
I think if you love something that much and you're ambitious and you want to do something with your life and deciding that that's not going to be it, that must have been hard.
Yeah, that was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough.
How old were you when you said, okay, I can't do this?
You know, I was really young. I was really, you know, I started playing piano when I was 9, and probably by the time that I was 11, I knew.
Really?
Yeah. But that still didn't stop me. You know, my hunger for it was like it really, you know, that was intense. That was an intense Jones. I was Jonesing.
When did it switch over to, okay, I'm gonna pursue acting?
When I found acting. You know, like when I was, you know, 14. I was on stage and went, oh, yes.
And did you think that, did you have the wherewithal or the, in Georgia, to know how to pursue it? Like, did you have parents that said, oh, here's what you do, and you can go to schools that have good drama programs? I mean, how did you know what to do?
Well, I was in a high school drama department, and one of our plays called The Flowering Peach. It was about Noah's Ark. And we put it up, put this play up, and then it went to Atlanta, and we were like in a state competition, Georgia State competition, and our play, we showed our play for like judges.
Oh, wow.
I don't even, you know, and all these plays competed against each other for whatever that's worth. And one of the judges was the director of the Alliance. He was the artistic director of the Alliance Theater, which is like the regional theater.
Okay.
In Georgia.
Okay.
In Atlanta. And so he ran a summer stock repertory theater in upstate New York, just outside of Ithaca. And he approached me after the competition and said, hey, you know, would you like to be a member of my company?
Oh, really?
In upstate New York. And I was 15. And so that meant that I would go away for 3 months and apprentice and, you know, turn turntables and build sets and paint chairs and, you know, wash actors, you know, laundry after every performance and maybe be in the chorus. And my parents said yes. So I spent 3 months when I was 15 in the summer with this professional acting company. And I went, oh, this is it.
That's amazing.
I want to do this for a living, you know.
So you were kind of discovered in a way.
Yeah, it was a completely humbling experience. In a way, doing that is like waiting tables. You know, you must be in a service position at some point in your life. You must be. To be humbled, you know, to treat people with respect and equanimity, you have to be in a service position. And
yeah.
I was serving actors. And that allows you to treat people. You get the entree. Oh, you should treat people well.
Did you, once you said this is it, did you have a plan B or a time limit that you gave yourself where it's like, oh, if this doesn't work out or?
No plan B.
No plan B.
That was a bit, you know, that had some moxie.
Yeah.
No plan B. But I also think it was just ignorance. Like, but there was ego there. Like, I don't know. But it comes out of ignorance. Like, yeah, I'm going to act. Not like, oh, I want to be a movie star. I was like, I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to be a stage actress. That was like, that's what I'm going to do.
But isn't moxie the very thing you need to become an actress anyway?
Well, it's got to be somewhere in the recipe, I guess.
Yeah, or delusion or possibly just blind
yeah,
luck.
Some
or...
parts delusion, definitely.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's basically youth. What you need is youth. Because, you know, there's an invincibility that's like in the DNA of youth.
Yeah, you can't be someone who runs the numbers and go and figures out how many people are thinking that same thing and going to New York.
Yeah.
Well, God, you know, I could talk to you about this forever, and obviously I can't because it's not a seven-hour show. But I do want to...
What if it was 24 hours? What would that be like?
I could
wow,
do it.
Man.
I could do it. We could do just a 24-hour show.
We'd have like some black beauty standing by.
I think at the end of 24 hours, we'd be like,
don't they?
We didn't even scratch the surface. You know what I mean? I think the deeper you go, you realize how deep you have to go.
Well, it's really fun to have this kind of stretch out, you know, in an interview format because this is never.
I know.
There's no one else that does this. You know,
you're
very unaware of, you know, your crew is extremely supportive. Your guys are like, you're part of... We're all part of this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the community.
Can you go and advocate for us?
Because well,
you know what we're doing.
I don't
doing.
Need to advocate. You know for what you we're guys. Doing here. You got it going on.
I read this article that was titled "We Have All Failed Holly Hunter," and it was really a treatise on roles for women in film, and it used you as an example of someone who had these amazing roles from Raising Arizona to Broadcast News to The Piano, and the kind of acting you were doing that was so powerful, and then watching the film business turn to it being harder and harder to find roles like that for women in story. And I wonder, with some distance now in the business, if you look back at that and if you feel that's accurate, or if you feel like it's hard for everybody. You know what
well,
I mean?
I mean, look, it's a really interesting article, and you know, my totally slagging it off. It's interesting. Of course, it's a hurtful article to a degree. It's a totally accurate article to a degree. It's not revelatory to me, because it's my career, and I certainly know my career, and I know all of these things. It's like in order to be an actress, there's so much that you know. Somebody my age, or even younger, slightly younger than me, there's a lot of information that you accrue through putting together a career that's a few decades long. And sexism is totally involved in that, in that information. And it plays a massive role. I mean, we found that out when Jennifer Lawrence was making less money than one of her co-stars, who, and she's a major movie, she's a movie star. She satisfies the hunger that a lot of people have for that kind of somebody to occupy that position. You should pay her for that too. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it was really cool when that got broken out, that information.
Yeah.
But the fact is that sexism with roles, like, we don't need to see this woman anymore. She's beyond a certain age. Let's, you know, we need 25-year-olds. Those are the interesting women's roles we want to see. We want to see those stories. And that's unfortunate. And it's also, you know, for me, frustrating that the woman who I see absolutely most prominently is Meryl Streep, of a woman of that age, the role seemed to be occupied by Meryl. This
right.
is nothing against Meryl. Meryl is one of the most extraordinary actresses who have ever lived, and like nobody's arguing about that. But I would like to see more women who are in Meryl's generation tell stories to me. I want to hear them, and I want to see them. And my career has definitely had major ebbs and flows. And right now, I'm in more of a flow. Well, that's cool. But I'm not the most ambitious actress that you've ever had sit in this chair either. I mean, I'm not like filled with ambition. I'm filled with ambition with my characters. But beyond that, I can be a little lax. You know, I like my life. I don't need to work all the time, you know. So it's also been hampered by, you know, the world has failed Holly Hunter, whatever that was. It's like, well, but also I can opt out. Not because I've never, like, been in retirement at all. I love to work, but I don't love to work all the time.
Right.
I have other things that I like. But nevertheless, there has not been a plethora of fantastic roles that I'm like swatting away.
So to me, that's the point of the article, I think, that I agreed with most, that if there is only a handful of actresses that we can say that are a certain age that are amazing, why is there only a handful? It's because there's only a handful of roles that there's fewer slots. Like, how do we reflect our own humanity if our stories are mostly male-centric or young or youth-centric? Well, and you mentioned Jennifer Lawrence, and I wonder if you think, like, wow, she doesn't know what's coming, you know, and if she hits a certain age or whatever, or if we're beyond that. And
I would say we're not beyond that. I mean, this is kind of everywhere. I mean, power is threatened by a minority. You know, power is threatened by a minority that's beginning to realize that it's that minority has a voice. You know, women can say this, blacks can say this, you know, Kumail has this, you know, the brown voice of the big sick. It's not that he's going, you know, hey man, I want more room, but it's like he has this voice, this beautiful story to tell that's not like power hungry. It's just a story. He has a perspective. He has this thing that, hey, I had this happened to me and I want to talk about it. They wrote a movie about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, women in the boardroom, women in major roles, one of the reasons why I wanted to do Strange Weather is to have the stretch out room of like doing every single scene. Wow. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to get to have that much expansion.
Yeah. Well, I think that if anything, going back through so many films in anticipation of you coming here, I'm astonished by the amount of humanity that you put into the characters and how much more I invest in the stories because of your performances. And I want to keep seeing your work. You know, I want you to work more. And it's been fascinating talking to you. And I wish we had more time.
Thanks so
truthfully.
Much. Yeah, no, it's just been really, really fun.
Well, folks, that's our show for today. And it's sort of the end of our season, at least for a short time. More on that in a minute. Make sure you go see Holly Hunter in The Big Sick and Strange Weather. You'll laugh and you'll cry in both those films. At least I did. And quite honestly, Holly's doing some of the greatest work in her career. So check those films out. You'll be glad you did. And for those of you that listen to us every week, you know that Off Camera is not only a podcast, but we're also a TV show and a magazine. I know that's a bit confusing, but if you haven't checked it out, it'll all become clear when you go to offcamera.com. There you can check out an archive of over 110 shows. And if you want to see what this conversation sounds like, the best way to do that is by getting a monthly subscription to our television show. That's right, for under $5 a month, you can watch as much off-camera as you can handle. It's a great way to catch up on the entire archive, and it's a great way to support the show. And while you're there, check out our magazine too. If you go to the off-camera store, you'll see that we make an exclusive limited edition black and white magazine for each guest that comes on the show. There you'll find longer conversations and the photographs I take of each guest. It's a cool way to spruce up your coffee table and to show some love to off-camera. I want to thank everyone that works on the show with me. We couldn't do this without our whole off-camera crew. Making a television show, a podcast, and a magazine is not easy, and we have a small but dedicated group of people who bring you the show each week. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Laura Kemper, Michaela Galvin, Amy Jones, Justin Kennedy, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson. And most of all, thank you. We wouldn't have a show without listeners. So please, tell your friends about the show, spread the word, and let's keep Off Camera going for as long as we can. And now about that little summer break. Off Camera's going on a brief summer hiatus to work on our next run of conversations. And we'll be back on the air Monday, September 4th on television and Thursday, September 7th for the podcast. Just remember to apply sunscreen and don't run by the pool because nobody wants that because you'll slip and crack your head and then, well, we've lost a listener. And we need each and every one of you. Enjoy your summer, everybody. And if you get lonely, send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can find us on social media at Off Camera Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. See you in September, Off Camera.